Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Although featured nationally on 48 Hours, Dateline, and the Oxygen Network, the detailed, complete, and totally unbelievable story of the case of David Kam has never been fully revealed as police, prosecutors, forensic scientists, and judges either sought or facilitated the convictions of an innocent man while ignoring a mountain of exculpatory evidence. While David was being pursued, persecuted, and incarcerated, Kim, Brad, and Jill Kam's true killer, a devil-worshipping, sexual-obsessed, 11-time convicted violent psychopath, was left free to roam the streets of metropolitan Louisville, Kentucky. Once identified by his DNA, but only through the efforts of David's uncle and defense team, that same cold-blooded murderer was treated, incredibly, first as a victim and then shockingly as an accomplice of David. Their bloody lies and persecution of David Kam is a chilling, reprehensible, yet very tragic and true American crime story, leaving readers demanding, how did this case happen and why was this travesty allowed to continue? Sam Lockhart absolutely knew his nephew couldn't have killed his wife and children, for he was with David and 10 other people at the time of the murders. For 13 years, and at an enormous personal and financial cost, Sam, his family, and business suffered the disdain of those in the local community. But Sam never lost focus of his ultimate goal, the exoneration of David and justice for Kim, Brad, and Jill. Gary M. Dunn was a 27-year veteran agent with the FBI in Miami, Chicago, Gary, Indiana, and Southern Indiana, with a wide array of experience investigating corruption, terrorism, white-collar and violent crimes, while often dealing with true psychopaths. After becoming the private investigator for David's second defense team, he was stunned by the incompetent, biased investigations, lack of a fair and partial justice system, and those who claimed to be forensic scientists. Follow his and the defense team's investigative path in A Case You Won't Soon Forget. The book that we're featuring this evening is Their Bloody Lies and Persecution of David Kam, Part 1, with my special guest, private investigator and former retired FBI agent and author, Gary M. Dunn. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Gary M. Dunn.
Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity to perhaps educate a bunch of people on things that they think they might know, but unfortunately truly don't.
Absolutely. First off, tell us about your law enforcement background further, and also how you came to be involved in this story.
Certainly. I retired from the FBI in 2003 after 27 years. I had been assigned throughout the United States, conducting white collar, violent crime, property crime, terrorism, counterintelligence investigations. I had a very in-depth background on investigations and also involved in several undercover operations. After I retired from the FBI in 2003, I went into academia and I thought I was going to spend my remaining retirement years teaching. That didn't pan out because I missed investigations. And so in 2004, I left teaching and hung out my private investigator's shingle. I was soon contacted by a Bloomington, Indiana attorney, Catherine Lyle, Kitty Lyle, and she asked me to get involved in a nonviolent criminal investigation, white collar, about 100 miles away from Bloomington. And I did not want to get involved in any criminal investigations. I was going to confine my investigations to white collar, civil, perhaps insurance fraud, things of that nature. But she intrigued me, and so I got involved in this small case in southwestern Indiana. And it was during the investigation of that case, which she told me that her client was innocent, and as I found out, he absolutely was, that she broached the idea of becoming involved in the David Kam case. I remember that very, very clearly. Kitty told me that he too was innocent, and as luck would have it, he was from Floyd County, Indiana, which is just north of Louisville, Kentucky, sitting right there on the Indiana-Ohio River border. And I knew about him. I knew about the crimes for which he was convicted. And even though I did not verbalize it at the time, I told Kitty, well, I'll think about it, thinking that there's no way in the world I was getting involved in this case. For David Kam, a 10-year Indiana State Police trooper, said that on September 28, 2000, that he had returned home from playing basketball at a church gym. And a few miles from his home in rural Georgetown, Indiana, which is about 10 or 12 miles from Louisville. And there, once he opened the garage door, he saw a clump laying on the garage floor, which he first thought was his daughter, Jill, 5 years old. He jumped out of the cab of his pickup truck, ran into the garage, and saw that the person was actually his wife, Kim. Kim, who had a massive head wound, and whose wound was at a huge, huge pool of blood around her head and was streaming out of the garage. After the shock of seeing his wife, whom he knew to be dead, his immediate thoughts went to his daughter, Jill, 5 years old, and son, Brad, 7 years old. Adjacent to Kim's body was the family Bronco, Ford Bronco, and Dave looked in the passenger side of the Bronco. It's a two-door, not a four-door, and he saw his little daughter still strapped in the back seat, passenger side of that car, and she too had been shot through the head, and she too was quite clear was deceased. He looked and saw his son, Brad, in the back seat behind the driver's seat, and Brad had attempted, quite apparently, to have gotten away from the shooter, the killer, where he was, his body was draped over the back seat. Not seeing a head wound, as he had with his wife and daughter, they thought that Brad might still be alive. And so he went into the interior of the car through the passenger seat, through the twin bucket seats in the front, placed his left knee on the back bench seat of the back seat, grabbed his son, cradled him in his arms, and removed him from the vehicle. And he lay down on the garage floor and began CPR, albeit two was for naught because Brad too was dead. He then ran into the house. You have to understand that the garage was detached from the house and with a breezeway or a porch between the garage and the house. He ran into the house and there on a wall phone, a landline, called his old friends at the Indiana State Police Sellersburg Post. Dave had left the state police about 6 months prior after 10 years of service. He had gone and worked for his uncle, Sam Lockhart, in a foundation repair and waterproofing business and was doing quite well financially. Kim, I should add, was an accountant working at Aegon International in Louisville, very respected, doing quite well. The family was very financially secure. Anyway, Dave called the state police. And that later became a bone of contention because people would question why he called the state police post where he had worked for 10 years rather than calling 911. Anyway, he got a hold of the post command there, the trooper in charge of the post that evening. And this was about 9:28 p.m. at night. And he told him to send everyone. The call is nerve-rattling for anybody that hasn't heard it. But nonetheless, he said he had to do something. And then he ran out of the kitchen and out of the breezeway and across the gravel road to the residence of his grandfather, Amos Lockhart. Now, Amos Lockhart had purchased the land on which Dave's house and several others said there was an 80-acre parcel of land. And Amos and his wife, Daisy, had built their house there many years before. But his grandfather was aged in his 90s, and one of his nine children was staying with him each and every night. So that particular night was Nelson Lockhart, who had retired after 35 years with the Kentucky State Police and the Jefferson County Police Department. David screamed to his uncle that his family had been killed. Nelson ran across the gravel road barefoot back into the front of the garage. And there, as saw Kim, was shocked, even though he had a 35-year police career and had seen death many times over. And David told him to check on Jill in the backseat, which Nelson quickly did, found her to be cold and clammy and knew that she too was deceased. It was then that he told his nephew, "We have to get out of this garage. It's a crime scene," in which they did leave. Shortly thereafter, about 9:42 p.m., the state police units began arriving. And within the next 20 to 30 minutes, literally dozens of police officers from a varied number of different agencies, the Floyd County Sheriff, the Indiana State Police, the Georgetown Police Department, any number of emergency units arrived upon the scene. And the first state police units there confirmed that all three were deceased. They ran into the house, at least two or three of them, to clear the house to make sure that there was no one else in the house, and also to attempt, of course, to see if the perpetrator was inside. They found nothing. Also, one of the first to arrive on the scene about or less than an hour after the state police arrived was the Floyd County prosecutor, a fellow by the name of Stan Faith. He arrived with several others from his office, including several of his investigators. It was that evening when an investigative plan was brought together by the state police. The lead detective designated at that time was Sean Clements. Lieutenant James Biddle was the regional investigative commander, who was the overall person in charge of the scene. Another fellow there who was the acting district commander from the investigations for the Sellersburg Post was Mickey Neal. And together they all came upon an investigative plan. I should add that there were several troopers stationed throughout the neighborhood, including Mary Hager, who secured some excellent information early on, as did other troopers who were doing what they were assigned to do. And one of the troopers at the head of the driveway, Lockhart Road, I should add, is a dead end. The gravel road is a dead end off of another road, Alonzo Smith Road. But the trooper assigned at the entrance there came up with two very important pieces of information. The first of which was that the neighbor residing there had seen Kim Kim's black Bronco arrived shortly after the neighbor had sat down to watch his evening regimen of Jeopardy. And this was on a Thursday evening. And he saw and noted the time was right at 7:35 p.m. That neighbor's son had skipped school that day and was working on his vehicle in the driveway, which was parallel and adjacent to Lockhart Road. When around 2 or 2:15, he noticed a dark-colored Cadillac turn into Lockhart Road, a car that he had never seen before. And this Cadillac he saw, but he only saw images, of course, had a driver he saw, but it also had a passenger image. After a few minutes, the Cadillac returned and was turning right or south on Lonzo Smith Road, and it spun grab on the left at a fairly high rate of speed. And anyway, so this trooper assigned to monitor traffic in and out of the crime scene came up with two very critical pieces of information. We knew that Kim and the kids would certainly have to have been killed after 7:35. And by the way, I should mention that their previous efforts that day, after Kim got off work, as she took her daughter Jill to a dance class from 4 to 5 p.m., and Jill was very active there, wearing her leotards, and the dance instructor, you remember, she came out of the room and into the dance room, and she led the other little kids in a choo-choo train line, and Jill was very, very engaged. She was just a wonderful little girl, active, and she was very active that day. When her brother had swim practice between 6 and 7 that day, and both these activities occurred in New Albany, while Brad was swimming, his little sister Jill was in the adjoining gym, running up and down the bleachers and watching a volleyball game. And Mother Kim was in the bleachers at the swim practice and engaged with and talking with other women. So now we've got the setup for the time. And we do know that Kim's cell phone, there was an attempted call at 7:50 p.m. that evening, which would indicate that either she was alive or someone tried to call or in a frenzy perhaps had grabbed a cell phone and was an unconsummated phone call to a lady who was renting a rental property from Kim and Dave. So we know that, and we also know, and I'll mention this shortly, as to the forensics which was found at the scene. And the forensics, indeed, I indicated that Dave saw the huge pool of blood around Kim's head, but it wasn't just a pool of blood. It had separated, a blood serum had separated, and there was a distinct color difference, the plasma color versus the deep red from the red blood cells. And interestingly enough, before the blood was able to run down the small inclination in the garage, there was a lineal line, a damming line, where clearly something had blocked it, had blocked the pooling and then blocked the damming. And it was very clear in the crime scene photograph. So that would indicate that blood serum separation, that it takes, depending on the temperature, depending upon other variables, it takes for blood to separate anywhere from up to an hour, at least based upon what occurred that evening. So when indeed the state police investigators saw this blood, it was clear that it had to have been after 7:35 when the attacks on Kim and the kids occurred. And it also had to have been backtracking from the time they arrived there at 9:42. It had to be at least an hour, if not longer, prior to that when the attacks occurred. So we're talking 7:35 to around 8:35 or 8:40. But that was the forensics at the scene, which would have indicated that they were attacked at that time. And not only that, but Brad was still in his swim trunks, and he had his warm-up pants over those swim trunks. And Jill was still strapped in the back seat of the car in her seatbelt. And all those things would indicate that the time was probably almost immediately after they got home that evening, or around 7:35.
Tell us about where Dave Kam is supposed to be and how investigators go verifying his alibi.
Certainly.
Tell us where he says he is. Of course, he's questioned immediately. Tell us about what they gain information-wise from him.
Certainly. Dave was at a basketball game in the church gym in nearby Georgetown, Indiana, a few miles from his residence. He was playing there. This was a normal Thursday evening game, and they would play around from 7 to 9 o'clock. They wanted to have a full-court 5-on-5 game because it was pretty competitive. Well, that evening, previous evenings, I should say, they didn't always have 5-on-5, so they tried to round up enough guys that evening. And they did get, by 7:05 or so, there had been exactly 10 people show up. An 11th one showed up about 7:15 or 7:20, that being Sam Lockhart. But nonetheless, we know based upon the records at the alarm records at the church gym, that the alarm was disengaged at 6:59 and everybody was there, certainly said they was there. And so they played their 5-on-5 games. Sam Lockhart, the 11th person, didn't play until after 8 o'clock. So we know that Dave certainly played after arriving there and played up until 8 o'clock and then passed that because another person, a church elder, Tom Jolly, arrived around 8:15 or 8:20. And he said that when he got there, they were finishing a game. And it was on that game that Dave said, set out and said, told Sam, he says, you played for me. So now we have 10 on 10 still, but instead of Sam Lockhart sitting out, it's Dave Camp, who, by the way, is Sam's nephew. So during the time that he's not playing, Dave is on the sideline speaking with Tom Jolly, and one of Tom's sons was close friends with Dave. And so they talk. And then about the time that the other game was getting ready to finish, Dave started warming up again. And then he went in for another fella who left the gym. And so it's still 5-on-5. And we're 5-on-5 up until 9 o'clock. At that time, 8 guys said, well, let's play 4-on-4. And they did, with 2 other guys leaving. So the 8 remaining ones stayed there until 9:22. And we know it was 9:22 because that was the time when the alarm was reengaged. And that was done so by Jeff Lockhart, the church's minister's son and a cousin of Dave's. So now we know that Dave is there between 6:59 and 9:22. They all leave after exiting the building at 9:22. And Dave, at 3.5 miles to get to his house, takes him 5 or so minutes. And so that puts us around 9:27. But, and you mentioned his alibis, those basketball players were not alibi witnesses until the prosecutor changed his theory on what happened. And this is critical. Within 18 hours, of course, all 3 victims were given autopsies at the Kentucky Medical Examiner's Office in nearby Louisville. Kim had bruises, 22 bruises, cuts, nicks all over her body, including on her chin, as though she'd been hit with an uppercut. She had bruising on her knees and on the tops of both feet. There were lacerations and as though someone had stomped on them. Kim also had been found with her white pants off and her shoes sitting on top of the car on the Bronco. One of the crime scene techs said he had never seen so much hair on a sweater because Kim's sweater was just loaded with her own hair, as though someone had pulled it out. Clearly, there had been a ferocious struggle between Kim and her assailant. Also, Kim was found with black panties on. Since her white pants were missing, obviously, the first thought would be that maybe this was an attempted sexual assault. Strangely, the state police did not go that route. They dismissed that out of hand. They also dismissed that there was any possibility of a burglary in the house. The reason there is because one of the crime scene techs said that there was no forcible entry. The only problem there is, of course, is that the cams never locked their doors. There wouldn't have been any needed forcible entry. But one trooper did notice the strangeness, Kim wearing black panties under white pants, and that was Shelley Romero, a female trooper, who said that never would have occurred.
Right.
There was something strange there. Not only that, but she had seen that the panties were tucked inwards, and which was strange. So she brought this to the attention of the other investigators. And as with the sexual attack or the robbery, the burglary, it went nowhere. But nonetheless, the next day at the medical examiner's office, they certainly determined that both Jill and her mother had been killed through a gunshot through the head. Brad had been killed through a wound that had severed his spinal column. He probably didn't die quickly, but hopefully he was unconscious whatever amount of time that he did live. But also noted at the autopsy was that Jill had injuries to her external genitalia, a cut and a nick on her external genitalia, which was erroneously labeled as a trauma to her vagina. And
right.
Later on, that became trauma that was consistent with sexual intercourse. When that information came from the medical examiner's office, and by the way, that was not the report of the medical examiner. Her report was that Jill suffered non-specific blunt force trauma, meaning obviously something caused it, but we don't know what it was. So there was never a finding of sexual intercourse or molestation, and certainly nothing that would link her father to the injuries, whatever their cause. Nonetheless, within 18 hours, the word got out that Dave Cam had molested his daughter, which was totally erroneous and totally without merit and totally without evidence. But nonetheless, from that, things sprung into action from determining who was responsible for this very heinous crime into building a case against David. In concert with that, Stan Faith, the prosecutor, had already been on the phone with his preferred bloodstain and bloodstain pattern analyst, a fellow by the name of Rodney Englert out of Oregon. Englert had worked on 2 cases for Mr. Faith previously, And Faith was very pleased with the results. And he asked Englert to come to Indiana and to get involved in the murders of Kim and Brad and Jill. Englert said he was unavailable. He was teaching a course, I believe, and I think in Arizona. But nonetheless, he said he would send his trusted protege, a fellow by the name of Robert Stites. Stites arrives the next day, Saturday, September 30th, and he is immediately driven to the Kentucky Medical Examiner's office. Stites, being the crime scene reconstructionist that he portrays himself to be, then takes pictures of the three victims, also does his own scientific measurements with a dowel rod through wounds using a protractor, among other things, goes to the crime scene and is given full and complete charge of that crime scene. At the time, and unbeknownst to most people, he's making certain proclamations and also ordering certain pieces of what he thinks is evidence to be collected. One of the crime scene technicians said in no uncertain terms, "Get this son of a bitch out of here. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing." He was told that Mr. Faith, the prosecutor, wants him here and he's staying here. And so Rob Stites did stay there. The next morning, that being October 1st, Sunday, Stites goes to the Indiana State Police Post in Sellersburg and breaks out his microscope, or check that, his magnifying glass, and starts looking at the clothing worn by David Kam, by the victims. And within a few minutes, but only after being told that David is the suspect and or shooter, does Mr. Stites make a determination that eight tiny stains on Dave Kam's shirt on the lower left front of the shirt are the result of HVIS. That's a fancy term for blowback, blood blowback, HVIS being high velocity impact spatter. So Stites says that Dave Kam had to have been present when this blood blowback occurred, and ergo, he had to have been the shooter. So with that information, plus what the lead detective, Clemens, had determined, an affidavit is put together that Sunday afternoon. And that affidavit charges, let me actually look at this affidavit and precisely tell you what it says. It says, among other things, and this was a conclusion of Robert Stites, the purported bloodstain expert and crime scene reconstructionist. Right. The crime scene was manipulated by use of a high pH cleaning substance. Well, there was no indication of that whatsoever. And indeed, lab results later on said there was nothing which indicated that at all. Certainly no evidence. The t-shirt worn by David Kam had high velocity blood, as I indicated, which occurs in the presence of gunshot. Well, keep in mind that bloodstain opinions are just that. They're opinions. And one person, as been told before, may see a cloud, the other one may see a clear sky. It's hard telling. One expert might see over the next. But anyway, as the cleaning substance was thrown over the back deck, that's not true because of stains which this bloodstain expert and crime scene reconstructionist Stites had observed had been there for months. Witness said that between 9:15 p.m. and 9:30, she heard three distinct sounds that can be interpreted as gunshots, meaning that, of course, would have been the time that the murders occurred. That witness, however, was the neighbor in the woods from David, Debbie Turvey, who also was his aunt. She never said that. Her husband's a former police officer. She'd been involved in law enforcement. She knew what gunshots sounded like, and she said she had never said that. And Clemens misquoted her completely. By the way, she was outraged. Also indicated that one of the allegations, Jill, age 5, had a recent tear in the vaginal area consistent with sexual intercourse. That was absolutely not correct. Another allegation, there was a wet mop and a bucket in the utility room of the house with a strong odor of bleach. What the hell that meant, who knows? You would think a mop and bleach would be found in a utility room, but they were, the inference was that was what was used to clean the crime scene. And here's another good one. Witnesses playing basketball with David Kam said he left the game on or around 9 p.m. Well, there were eight people playing basketball at 9 until 9:22. No one said that. No one whatsoever. That is just a blatant falsehood. And there is this other allegation. There was a flow of blood from the garage that is inconsistent with the viscosity of blood. That was the blood around Kim's head, and which had a distinct difference in coloration, and which was due to a natural phenomena of blood serum separation. The blood stain expert, the blood expert, Robert Stites, didn't recognize that, and he thought something had been added to that, all in an attempt to manipulate the crime scene. And I should add also that the state police said that David Kam had manipulated the pants being off Kim and place the shoes on top of the car in order to give the impression of a sexual assault. So they had manipulation on the mind. About the only thing they got right in this first affidavit was that Kimberly Kim and Jill Kim were killed by gunshot wounds to the head with a .380 caliber firearm, and that Brad's wound was to the chest, which was also fatal. And Robert Stites, once again, is listed as the crime scene reconstructionist. We later find out that, but not until after Dave's arrested that evening, that Robert Stites is not any expert. His experience, expertise, and education is far from that of a crime scene reconstructionist or true forensic scientist. But nonetheless, David is called to the state police Sellersburg Post on the afternoon of October 1st, where he is interrogated, and he is told that in no uncertain terms, they got him. They know that Jill had been molested. They know that he had high velocity impact spatter on his t-shirt, and he is incredulous. He is shaken to the core about hearing about his daughter being molested. He denies ever harming her. He denies ever shooting a gun, killing his kids. And he keeps telling them, your blood expert is wrong. Your blood expert is wrong. But nonetheless, at that time, the lead interrogator, Mickey Neal, steps out and has Rob Stites. He tells him, he says, how sure are you about that bloodstain conclusion that you reached? And Stites supposedly says about 90%. And Neil says, I don't want to hear 90. He says, I want to hear 100%. So here's where we get a divergence of recollection. Stites says that he calls his boss, Rod Englert, and describes the stains to him. And according to Stites, Englert said, well, that's right. You've got it, buddy. That's high velocity. Stites, the mentor of, or rather Englert, the mentor of Stites, he says, oh, no. I would never, ever make a conclusion of HVIS over the phone. Nonetheless, one is inconsistent with the other's recollection. Still, Dave is arrested that evening, on the evening of October 1st. He is put into the Floyd County lockup in a padded cell for suicide watch, where there's complete denial of accessibility at that time to anyone to comfort this man who's just lost his wife and kids in a most heinous crime. I should also add that Brad's face had stippling on it, which indicated that the muzzle of the gun was within close proximity to his face when he was shot. That meant, of course, that Brad, 7 years old, God bless him, was facing the murderer and knew he was going to be shot. Certainly, I think he had seen his mother and little sister killed as well. Very horrifying. And that indicated to me, of course, that whoever perpetrated these crimes was the most despicable coward imaginable. Regardless, this is the crime that I look back upon. And upon my entry into the case in late 2004, I wanted to see what they had, the state police and the prosecutor had at the time they arrested Dave. And that's what they had. And they had a probable cause affidavit that did not contain any probable cause whatsoever. They did not have the wherewithal, at least evidence-wise, to have charged him. But they did. And it became readily apparent, I found out, that within a short period of time after charging Dave, that Faith knew he had a horrific problem on his hands. And that was, the family was not killed after Dave got home, but they were killed instead at the same time that he was playing basketball with 10 others and one spectator. Now think of that. And when I indicated before that these alibi witnesses weren't alibi witnesses originally, they only became alibi witnesses when the prosecutor changed his theory of what happened, changed his narrative. So now how do you have Dave Kim being the perpetrator when he's playing basketball at the same time? Well, that was easy enough for Mr. Faith to do, because he then said that these witnesses, the basketball players, some of whom didn't even know Dave, were either mistaking or lying. That they were lying when they said that he had never left the ball game, or lying when they said that no one had ever seen him leave. No one had ever seen him missing. So now you've got the problem of alibi witnesses saying, hey, he's here with us. One guy, and the prosecutor's own investigators trying to get these guys to say that, oh, yeah, you could have missed him. Well, no, we didn't miss him. They also tried to get some of those same ballplayers and say, well, he was wearing a sweatshirt that night, right? And the reason a sweatshirt was so critical at that time was because a sweatshirt, a gray sweatshirt, Hanes long sleeve, extra large sweatshirt, had been found on the garage at the crime scene. Interestingly enough, that same sweatshirt had hand printed in the back of the collar the word backbone in capital letters. Initially, Faith tried to link that to David, and he had a neighbor say, well, I saw a sweatshirt in a garage at one time, and David never had a gray sweatshirt. So that was a lie. But nonetheless, the state police said, well, this is really nothing more than just an artifact. It doesn't mean anything. And that was something that I saw was consistent. If they couldn't explain something, it never meant anything. It was just something that was nonsensical or not critical or not relevant. So we got a sweatshirt there. We also have Ken's shoes on top of the car, which weren't explained other than trying to put that on Dave as manipulating the crime scene. So now we've got the prosecutor trying to get Dave out of those ball games and killing at home, killing Kim and the kids. So how's he going to do that? And how's he going to convict Dave? Well, as I indicated, the ball players were either mistaken or liars. And later on in that first trial, he asked them the score of certain games. He asked them who they were guarding, how many points they had scored. And of course, these people don't remember that. In fact, most of the ball players had never been interviewed in person until after Dave had been charged, because they knew that Dave had left the basketball games at 9, and therefore these ballers weren't important. But they turned out they were very critical. So now you got to make them liars. And it also, they never even knew until after Dave was arrested about the alarm in the church. They didn't know about the 6:59 alarm being disengaged and the 9:22 p.m. time of the alarm being engaged. They didn't have no idea about that. There was one state police officer who did his job. He did contact the ballers on the telephone, and he got very clear information from them that the earliest anybody thought they had left was 9:15. But yet Clemens, the lead detective, claimed it was 9 o'clock. So it's all screwed up. So the first narrative is wrong. It is completely wrong. And the affidavit basing the arrest of Dave for the murders of his wife and kids is, as I indicated, completely full of holes, lies, misrepresentations, and an opinion which is fraught with peril.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Talkspace. It's important to prioritize your mental health and wellness every day, because when you work on yourself, you'll start to see and feel positive changes in all areas of your life. The long-term effects of therapy can give you the tools to deal with challenges as they arise, strengthen your relationships, and give you a more optimistic outlook on life. There's no better time to invest in yourself than right now. Getting started is the most important part. There's no need to wait until something goes wrong in your life to work with a therapist. Of course, Talkspace is also there to help with any specific challenges you might be facing. It's the number one online therapy platform with thousands of licensed therapists trained in over 40 specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more. Your therapist can help you set and achieve your goals. Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end bank-grade encryption technology to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code TRUEMURDER to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's TRUEMURDER and Talkspace.com. Now, when we last left off, we talked about how on earth they could take the forensic evidence that they did have and twist and turn this information to their advantage to be able to prosecute David Kam at trial. Tell us what happens at trial despite his vigorous defense and also that the impossibility of David Kam, despite these 11 alibi witnesses, slaughtering his family.
Well, in that regard, it was quite easy because the prosecutor, Stan Faith, conjured up three motives. three motives which were, again, lies, but three motives which were designed to assassinate the character of Dave. I mentioned the one motive that he had killed his family because he had molested his daughter and therefore wanted to cover that up. Briefly deconstructing that, now think of this, Dave Kam, a 10-year police officer, is going to kill a child to hide molestation when he knows that the autopsy is going to reveal the evidence as such. So that is totally illogical, and in spite of not having any merit whatsoever, in spite of not having any evidence of any relationship between Jill's injuries, however they occurred, and her dad. The second motive was that, manufactured by Faith, was that David Kam killed for $600,000 of life insurance. And he even claimed that Dave's brother, who was a financial planner, had forged the signature of Kim on a life insurance policy that had been recently obtained. And that would have been in July, 2 months before the murders. Well, insurance on the family had been changed, but Kim, as I indicated, an accountant for an insurance, large insurance firm, she was the one who had done that, who had originated that, simply because Dave had lost his large group insurance policy with the state police, and she wanted to get him more coverage, which she did, over $300,000. And meanwhile, her coverage had only been increased by $18,000. And the allegation that Dave's brother, Danny, had forged the policy application was a complete lie. And at the first trial, that had been completely rebutted by several witnesses. The third motive behind, according to Faith, behind Dave committing these murders was that Dave had been unfaithful to his wife, Kim, and wanted a free lifestyle in the future. Well, the fact of the matter is that Dave, unfortunately, had affairs prior to the murders, but by all evidence, those had ceased quite a bit of time beforehand, and nonetheless, they were totally irrelevant anyway. If you're going to have that reasoning, then 50% of Americans and most people eventually get divorces. And so therefore, those 50% of Americans are capable of committing murder. And it's illogical. And not only that, but if Dave wanted the freedom to commit other affairs, well, he didn't have to kill his wife and family previously. So these were just three bogus motives made up by Stan Faith. But they were successful, because how inflammatory can it be that a father is accused of molesting his own daughter? And that was allowed in the first trial. But what caused the reversal of the three convictions in the first trial was the Indiana Court of Appeals recognized that the affairs was totally irrelevant, and it was used primarily, solely, quite frankly, for the purpose of sliming David Kam. And it was successful because the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, said, we are left with a distinct possibility that Dave Kam could have been found innocent, not guilty, but not guilty, were it not for the introduction of these affairs. And so what happened is that in the first trial, the prosecution was allowed to cheat. And they did. They got their convictions, but they were overturned in August of 2004. And that's when I became involved shortly thereafter, and after much arm twisting by Kitty Lyle and then her young associate, Stacy Juliana, they were the two attorneys who had achieved the reversal of Dave's first three convictions.
Right.
So I got involved in the fall of 2004, and that's when a new prosecutor, Keith Henderson, was involved. Keith Henderson, strangely enough, had gotten elected based in large part upon a major mistake made by Stan Faith in the first trial, when he claimed that he had evidence that a 7:19 p.m. phone call had been made from the Kam house. And it was to a person who was a prospective client of Dave's in the waterproofing business. The only problem with that, and of course, this was big news, headline news, Dave Kam was home at 7:19 calling a customer while he waited to ambush his wife and kids. The only problem with that, it was a 6:19 phone call. The billing process had not been changed. Indiana is strange. They've got two or three different time zones, depending on the time of year and depending on who's in the political power. But anyway, the call was actually at 6:19. So that was a major mistake by Stan Faith. And it caused, quite frankly, him to believe that he was defeated in the reelection bid by Keith Henderson, who's a former Indiana State Police trooper. So he organizes a team of fresh eyes in the fall of 2004, and he comes upon another affidavit, and he says, we're going to charge Dave Cam again, and we've got some new evidence. What's your new evidence? Well, Dave Cam was home at 7:19 p.m. waiting for the inference, waiting again to ambush his wife and kids. But clearly, these quote-unquote fresh eyes didn't know what the hell they were talking about, because that time had been clearly refuted by a telephone company billing expert in the first trial. So they got that wrong. And they also claimed that, oh, here we go again, Dave Cam had, by inference, sexually molested his daughter. And they go to great amount of detail in this, their probable cause affidavit in November of 2004. And again, is that, quote, she had blunt trauma to the vagina that was consistent with sexual molestation, end quote. No, it was non-specific blunt force trauma. But nonetheless, they state in the same paragraph that there were, quote, sexual devices found in the Cam home. And yes, they were. They were adult. Some people would call them toys. And indeed, that's what one of the state police officers who seized them called them. But having said that, they were consensual in nature. But that was, again, an attempt to slime. Here's another one. The trauma to Jill Cam's, quote, vaginal area is consistent with a sexual device and or a penis, end quote. Well, that's pretty damning, except left out of that allegation from this pediatrician was the words, quote, or any object that size and shape, period, end quote. So clearly they were sliming Dave as much as they could. And it's once again replete with other allegations. There was blood spray that was HBIS on his shirt, and there was a long distance phone call, as I mentioned, which had been refuted. And there's their new allegation is that they had a confidential informant that advised me that Dave Cam told him that Cam, quote, had shot and killed his wife and two children, period, end quote. Well, it took us several months to find out who that informant was. And he was a serial prison snitch who had testified in two other murders. But his claim to the state police officers was that Dave Cam had shot his wife while she was in the car and the car was outside the car.
Texting between two different kinds of phones makes photos blurry, ugly, and security risky. Not just that. It also makes video calling, editing messages, or leaving a group nearly impossible. With WhatsApp, everyone can enjoy seamless messaging with the protection of end-to-end encryption. Streamline your messages across all devices on WhatsApp. Message privately with anyone you want. Click the banner or download now to learn more.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off Super Paint products and Super Deck stains from June 14th through the 24th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to appreciate all the ways Black music brings everyone together. From the Saturday morning soundtrack that gets the whole family cleaning the house, to the beats at the block parties that bring the whole community together, celebrate the impact of Black music this month and beyond with State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Have you heard? Sling TV offers the news you love for less.
Hey, wait. You look and sound just like me. I am you. I'm the same news programs on Sling TV for less.
You mean you're me, but for less money.
A lot less. I'm all the favorite news programs and more on Sling TV starting at just $40 a month.
Everything great about me, but for less money?
Which makes me greater, don't you think? Get the news you love and more for less.
Start saving today. Visit sling.com to see your offer. Sling.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Garage. The guy couldn't even get the basic facts correct. Jill had been shot in the garage, outside the car, which was in the garage. But nonetheless, they used this guy and included him in the probable cause affidavit, recharging David. It was, and you ask, say, well, why in the world would they do that? Well, eventually they would do it in order to, first of all, get a judge to deny bond, because there's no specifics in there other than the generic Dave confessed. And secondly, what they did or what they were leading to do toward the second trial was to ensure that the jury would know that David Kam had been in prison. And the reason for that, of course, is that second jury supposedly is going to be unknowledgeable about his prior convictions and nothing about his incarceration. That was just a cheap way to get around that. And using an informant whose credibility wasn't even zero, didn't even rise to that. But it was pretty bad.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, we have to push ahead somewhat and get to the point of contention where Kitty and Stacy are pushing and have pushed Prosecutor Henderson to have that sweatshirt DNA tested, to put it submitted to into CODIS, and tell us about this effort and what it unearths eventually.
Certainly, Dan. Earlier, the State Police Lab, and by all accounts, they did a good job. And certainly the technicians there, firearms and the fingerprint technician, did a very, very good job. The DNA analyst found not only Kim's DNA on the sweatshirt, backbone sweatshirt, but also found unidentified female DNA. Mike McDaniel, Dave's first defense attorney, had that sweatshirt tested at a reputable outside lab, and they came out back with a finding of male DNA on the collar. McDaniel, Dave's defense attorney, asked Stan Faith to have that run through CODIS. After a period of time, and this was about 3 months before trial, Faith told McDaniel, hey, I ran that through CODIS. There's no results. So with Kitty, Stacy, and I, and of course, Sam Lockhart, Dave's uncle, were after the state police and Henderson to have this run again because we thought, hey, maybe this the holder of that unknown DNA profile, maybe his profile, the DNA, was entered since the first trial. Finally, after delays and Henderson kept putting off Kitty, she filed a motion to compel that this DNA be run. And only after the threat of that motion did Henderson have the state police check it out. And then in February of 2005, did the DNA come back identified to a fellow by the name of Charles Bonet. And Charles Bonet had his DNA entered into CODIS in July 1997 when he was an inmate at the Indiana State Prison. How then was it not identified by Stan Faith? Well, the reason was simple. It was because it was never run through CODIS. Faith told Dave's defense attorney that it had been and it had not been. But now we have Charles Bonet being identified. Well, who's he? He is a local New Albany guy who in 1988, 1989, while a student at Indiana University in Bloomington, began attacking women, co-eds, at night who wore pants because he said he could tell they had good-looking legs even though they wore pants, attacking them at night, tackling them, bruising them, causing injuries to them, punching them in the face for one item. And the item that he was stealing from them was one of their shoes. He did this five times at least, and search of his residence found that, among other things, he had shoes, he had women's panties as no doubt souvenirs. He eventually goes to prison, and then in 1991, he gets out of prison, September, and he's out of prison less than a month when he's back in Bloomington, and then in the possession of a .38 caliber revolver, he robs a apartment office of several hundred dollars, tying up two women and trying to at least one of them successfully, but then steals a car and leaves. A week later, he, with that same .38 caliber revolver, enters into an unlocked condominium near the IU campus, and there's three co-eds, 22 years of age, 21, and he tells them it's a armed robbery. By the way, he's not doesn't have a mask on or doesn't try to disguise himself. And throughout 15 or 20 minutes in the residence, among other things, he grabs one of the co-eds by the back of the hair, puts the gun to the back of her head, tells her he's going to blow her effing brains out if she screams or does anything. He goes upstairs, and on the countertop of one of the dressers is a picture of an Indiana State police officer in uniform who is the father of one of these girls. Bonet sees it, grabs it, slams it down, and says, "I hate cops." He then takes the three downstairs because he hasn't gotten enough money from them and tells them that he's going to take them to an ATM. They're going to withdraw all their money. And if anybody says anything or screams or whatever, he's going to kill them all. All three were concerned that they were also going to be raped in addition to being killed. He gets all three into the car of one of them. And at that time, thankfully, a neighbor had seen what this guy was doing, had called the Bloomington police, and two officers had arrived upon the scene and had drawn down on Bonet and told him to drop the gun, which he was slow in doing. And one of the officers, George Connolly, said he thought he was going to have to shoot the guy. Some would subsequent to what happened. Well, whatever. Anyway, so he's arrested, and then he begins bragging about what he did. And this guy, he likes to brag, but in a roundabout way about what happened. And he was bragging consistently about his success in armed robberies, although, of course, he got caught. But nonetheless, he is charged with armed robbery, charged with confinement, kidnapping, and is given 20 years. He gets three 20-year sentences, but they're concurrent rather than consecutive. And according to Indiana's Department of Corrections law, at that time, he had to serve 50%. So he's going to have to serve time from 1992 until 2002, 10 years at least. Except when he's in prison, he engages in a letter writing campaign, and he's claiming that he's a changed man. He's claiming that he's a Christian. He's claiming that he's going to hold his son, which he did have a child by that time, in his hands because this judge is going to see just what an exemplary kind of guy he is. And it works. Charles Bonet is released from prison in June of 2000, 2 years plus, well ahead of when his sentence was due to expire. He gets out of prison, returns home to New Albany, and gets a job at a woodworking factory in Louisville. And then he begins dating a girl by the name of Mala Singh. Mala Singh is of Trinidadian background, and Bonet meets her at a Louisville fast food restaurant. And she later becomes his girlfriend, live-in girlfriend. He's living with his mother in New Albany. And the location of where they live is near the New Albany Plaza, which is a large supermarket at Kroger's, and also a meat market at the time, Karam's Meats. And that's where Bonet's mother and he often go, both to the supermarket and to the meat market. That's literally within a 4 to 5 minute walk of that. And this is at a time in the summer of 2000. So now we have Bonet upon the scene, working night shift. And we also have him associated with another fellow, another co-worker at Anderson Woods, who we find out later is the probable supplier of a weapon to Bonet. This is what we find out as the defense,
right?
Not the police, because all during this time that Bonet's DNA is matched, the prosecutor and the fresh eyes are doing what they can do, including telling the public that nothing to see here, folks, just take it on down the line. Charles Bonet gave his sweatshirt to the Salvation Army, and it's only happened to be at a crime scene through no fault of his own, just bad luck. So This guy's an 11-time convicted felon, 10 violent felonies in his past, and they're claiming not a problem. Even when he attacked women for shoes, and clearly those shoes at the crime scene of Cannes, they were there for a reason, placed there very neatly on top of the car. But they also say that he's not to be no problem, even though they knew at the time he had flunked several polygraph exams from two different polygraph examiners, which clearly indicated that he was involved in this crime, that he had been responsible. But nonetheless, this big lie is told to the public, and all the time saying that David Cann, those eight tiny dots are compelling evidence. Well, so now we've got Charles Bonnet being interviewed over a period of 35 hours, the first 2 days, and that's February 17th and 18th, and along with those polygraph exams, failed polygraph, and the state police, the fresh eyes, and the prosecutors saying, not a problem, not an issue. It's still David Camp. Of course, we don't know a lot of this stuff until months later when we finally get the results of the interrogations. We also don't know at that time, but later find out that during the time that Bonnet was out prior to his arrest on March 3rd, that he made 29 separate contacts, telephone calls, including one of 58 minutes and another of half that time, but 29 contacts with the fresh eyes, and none of those were documented. Apparently, wow. One of those, I also interviewed Bonnet after we found out about him, and he told me that he had four sets of alibi witnesses for the night of September 28th of 2000. Now, think about that. He's able to tell me 4.5 years later where he was and at what time he was with these people on a date that should not have stood out to him at all. But nonetheless, he says, and he tells me, he says, well, my alibis began at 2 p.m. on the afternoon of September 28th. When I think about that, why would he even indicate that other than because that's when the neighbor kid saw this black Cadillac, dark Cadillac, going into and out of Lockhart Lane. Clearly, he was surveilling, reconnoitering the house. Otherwise, why would he begin his alibis at that time? Nonetheless, I interview all of these alibi witnesses, none of whom, when I interviewed him, weeks after he supposedly gave those alibis to the police, none of whom had been interviewed by those police. This is just head shaking. Why in the world would they not interview alibi witnesses of a man in a triple homicide investigation? Well, the answer is clear. They didn't want to. They didn't want their story challenged because it was still David Camp. And then here now we have this guy. He's still out and about. And we're also demanding, Kitty, Stacy, and the defense team are demanding that unidentified palm print found on the passenger side of the Bronco at the passenger post be identified. We're demanding that Charles Bonnet's prints be taken. For days, nothing happened. Finally, 4 days after my interview of Bonnet, they do get his prints down to the state police lab. And John Singleton, the fingerprint examiner, certainly a professional, he identifies them quite easily. Those unidentified prints, those belong to Charles Bonnet. So now the prosecutor was saying no evidence against Charles Bonnet when they had his previous criminal history, had his violent history toward women, his thefts of shoes, had his property, the sweatshirt, had his DNA there. None of that meant anything. But now what are they going to do when they've got his left palm print, which a right-handed shooter would be placing against a pillar post there in order to gain stability and reaching in and shooting those kids? Now he's got to make a decision. Okay, so here's what happens. They arrest Charles Bonnet and they get him in, and the line of questioning goes like this. Charles, we know you were there. Now tell us how David Camp killed his family. You cannot remotely imagine when I first saw those interviews, those interrogations, it was like, my God, did they not care at all about the truth? And my only deduction was that, no, they don't, because they could not give up the ghost on David Camp. So subsequent to that, and Bonnet does indeed come up with an ever-changing tale over 4 days, different interrogations, none of which does he ever say that he and Cam were involved in a conspiracy, none of which he only says he does, well, I just sold a gun to David Camp, and that's all I did. and my hands are clean. But at no time does he say anything that he was involved with him in the murders, Kim, Brad, and Jill, because he can't say that because he was the guy that did it, of course. But he also says, well, they said, well, how did you meet David Camp? He goes, oh, I met him at community park playing basketball. There were 16 to 18 other players there. Okay, Charles, who were, it was one, two names. He didn't have any names. So the irony here is just astounding that you have 16 to 18 other basketball players purportedly playing with David Kam and Charles Bonnet, none of whom have ever come forward. And so there's...
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Do you know about all the musical genres that were created by Black musicians? Like jazz, rock and roll, and folk music, to name a few. This Black Music Month, State Farm is celebrating the cultural impact and influence of music created and inspired by Black innovators. Next time you're enjoying a song, trace it back to its origins and see for yourself. Check out the Black Music Forever station on Pandora, brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Have you heard? Sling TV offers the news you love for less.
Hey, wait, you look and sound just like me.
I am you. I'm the same news programs on Sling TV for less.
You mean you're me, but for less money?
A lot less. I'm all the favorite news programs and more on Sling TV, starting at just $40 a month.
Everything great about me, but for less money?
Which makes me greater, don't you think?
Get the news you love and more for less.
Start saving today. Visit Sling.com to see your offer.
Sling.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
No validation, no verification, but yet 11 others who were playing with David were consistent. He never left. He never came back. He wasn't gone. That those are not to be believed, but you accept at face value Charles Bonnet contention that there were 16 to 18 others with him and David. It is just ludicrous. But his stories were ever changing. And finally, they say, and this is, I think you need them. There were three investigators who were interrogating Charles at this time. One was Detective Gary Gilbert. And here's some of his interrogation. Quote, we've tried and tried and tried to make your story fit, and it just doesn't. It just doesn't, Charles. And then we find this evidence comes about, and some more evidence comes about. He says, it's like pulling teeth. Frankly, I'm getting tired of it. You know the story, and you can fill in those missing parts. And frankly, I think we would have a better case with David Kam as well, end quote. Well, that's what they're trying to do, is get a connection that didn't exist between Bonnet and Kam. Detective Myron Wilkerson says, quote, David Kam does have an alibi. Do you understand? He really does. And that's going to be a problem. He has an alibi that is not matching up with what you're saying. If you're not careful, you're going to be a better witness for him than against him. Do you understand that? End quote. And then investigator Wayne Kessinger, quote, you're standing right in the middle of a triple homicide. Your sweatshirt and your palm print in that garage put you at the murder scene the night that happened. Because your story is a crock of shit the way you have explained it up to this point, end quote. So that's what they thought about Charles Bonnet. But then in a subsequent court proceeding, Keith Henderson, the prosecutor, files an aggravation motion charging that David Kam had hired Charles Bonnet to commit this murder. It's just lie upon lie upon lie.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, with this second prosecution, with this massaging, helping, educating, taking Bonnet's story and helping him along the way, it's fascinating how you chronicle how they massage and give him answers and tell him, well, that doesn't sound quite right. It is blatant and it is obvious to anyone reading this, the travesty that has occurred with this Charles Bonnet. With this as well, there is some other DNA that is found. And you talk about his girlfriend, Mala Singh, and your investigation and your interview. Tell us briefly what happens as a result.
Certainly. We were trying to identify this unknown female DNA, and we had found out about Mala Singh. And I had contacted a brother of hers in Louisville and had gotten his DNA in an attempt to see if we could identify the unknown female DNA on the sweatshirt. While we were trying to do that, the Fresh Eyes do indeed find her, and she's in Trinidad, and they obtain a DNA sample of hers. And lo and behold, it does match to the unknown female DNA on the sweatshirt. They bring her back to the United States. And this, once again, it's not question and answer. It's a tutorial, in my opinion. For what they do, they have her claim that she accidentally probably might have worn that sweatshirt when she and Charles were intimate. And it was during her monthly period when she got that blood on the shirt. And then she also says in one of her first interviews is that she clearly, in my opinion, my assessment, she clearly had much more knowledge about what happened that night. And I think quite possibly or maybe even probably was the person, the second person in that Cadillac that afternoon, because she was with Charles throughout that time. Charles, by the way, missed work that night, as did a co-worker of his, whom we think supplied the gun, the murder weapon. It was also, as I indicated, missing work. But nonetheless, Mala Singh, she's all over the place too, after she admits that Bonnet had seen and interacted with Kim and the kids at a nearby store. Now, whether that was Kroger's or Karen's, who knows? But she told them in no uncertain terms that Bonnet had known Kim and the kids before the murders. That would certainly indicate to me that he had targeted Kim, I believe, for a sexual attack and had followed her home and certainly knew where the residence was because of him reconnoitering it that afternoon. But later on, Mala, of course, she changes her mind after spending time in the custody of the Fresh Eyes and claimed that she never said that. So it's pretty sad all the way around. There's, in my opinion, certainly not a search for the truth, but indeed an attempt to find a narrative, find a story. And by this time, we're up into like six different stories that the prosecutors and the police are telling about what happened. It's pretty sad.
What about the contention that he was involved with Satanism?
Oh, yeah. Mala Singh certainly admitted that, as did Bonnet's second wife, both of whom said that he would wake up at night at midnight, light black candles, make incantations, chants to Satan while blaspheming God. He had a S pendant that he wore, and a lot of people thought that stood for Superman because he had a Superman tattoo on his chest. But his mission, at least private, was that it stood for Satan, whom he worshipped. Bonnet loves to mess with people. He loves to mess with people's mind. And that, you know, what better way to do it than to claim that you're a Christian while being just the opposite? That's just not the extent. He did it all the time. Among other things, he told the investigators of fresh eyes that he was aware that there was a unknown female, unidentified female DNA on the sweatshirt. And he says in so many words, well, who knows? Maybe that was the helper of the killer. It's just his way of messing with him.
Yeah. What I found interesting, and no answer to this, but I guess I would ask you, have the opportunity to, can you speculate to the importance of the shoes on top of the vehicle? And what we hadn't mentioned is that he had a known foot fetish by all the interviews that you had conducted, but also that there was one comment where he hated ugly feet.
Yes.
Can you tell us how you would explain the shoes at the scene and his involvement, Bonnet's involvement in this murder?
Sure. As I indicated, the shoes were placed very neatly on top of the Bronco side by side. And as I previously said, he had attacked women at night for their shoes. They were a prize for him. We also know by me talking with one of his very close friends that he had gone to a gentleman's club in Louisville and had paid $50 for a stocking for one of the adult dancers there. And he was smelling it, claiming to his buddy that it was fresh and he liked fresh ones. We also know from his first wife that he would routinely wake her up in the middle of the night, engaging in a sex act over her feet. And he'd stop people in the woodworking factory and ask them the women, please show me your toenail polish. At Kim's feet, she had chipped nail polish. Clearly, Kim was a hardworking mother, multitasking mother, who had other priorities rather than looking after toenail polish. Is it possible that when Bonnet saw those toes, that of course we know that he had fascinated them and was compulsive, had a compulsive fetish over shoes and feet? Is it possible that that caused part of his rage? It's certainly possible. Clearly, there was a link between her shoes on the Bronco and Charles Bonnet. I mean, it's a blind person could see that, but it was denigrated. And it was not allowed to be even argued once we established that link. Charles Bonnet is clearly a psychopath in my judgment, and I've interviewed thousands of people. Charles Bonnet has no conscience. He has no remorse. Him shooting and killing at point blank range two very innocent little kids, five-year-old Jill, who strapped in to a seatbelt, for God's sakes, totally harmless, and Brad, who's also in the back seat. But then again, they're not harmless if he indeed, as he told Mala Singh, had interacted with the family and they could have identified him.
Right.
And I believe that to be the case.
We talked about friends and family, Uncle Sam Lockhart, and the torment of the family and friends over this enduring and long-lasting ordeal through the judicial system. Tell us just a little bit about his involvement and what he has undergone through this entire thing.
Sure. Sam Lockhart. Sam was one of the guys playing basketball with Dave that night. He knew, obviously, that Dave didn't leave the gym, as Faith and Henderson later claimed. He knew that his nephew, it was totally impossible for him to be involved. But as I told you, the vilification of Dave spread to the family. And certainly Sam, because he was the most a pronounced advocate for Dave's innocence. Sam, who owned a company, competitors, at least one competitor, would tell customers or potential customers, hey, you know, if you go with Sam's company, you're only going to help fund a murderer and try and get a murderer free. And other would say, well, you know, why would Sam be supporting his nephew who molested little Jill? And the vilification, not only is Dave, but by extension, Sam, and the entire family. And Dave's two nieces were high school students later on, even during this. And my God, they were ridiculed, humiliated. It was never ending. Yeah, and I should also add that, you know, the trials eventually would cost people of Floyd County $5 million. And
wow.
$5 million. And when the county employees were unable to get raises because of the huge expense dedicated to the prosecution of Dave, some government officials would say, don't blame us, blame Dave Camp. You know, he's the one responsible for you not getting a raise. But Sam never withered. Sam was staunch. Sam was unbending. And indeed, Sam is a person with the greatest integrity I can imagine. He stood tall.
You were involved with this as part of the defense team for 8 months. This is only part one of the book, Their Bloody Lies and Persecution of David Camm. Tell us about part two. What's involved? When will it be released, do you think? Tell us about part two.
Yeah, there was so much involved. And one thing I wanted to do was to be detailed, to be accurate, to be honest. And in order to do that, it took quite a bit of time because there was so much to tell. And I still need to do that. The remaining part two is going to take us from 2005 up until the end of the Abe's quest for redemption, at least civil redemption, up until civil case was decided in early 2022. So there's a lot more coming, including the second and third trial. There's a lot more stunning information, a lot more revelations about how the lies continued to pour forth, how they hid information, how they twisted it, all in an attempt to keep Dave Camm incarcerated. It's, once again, quite sad, but part two will be out, hopefully no later than mid-2023.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah, and I should also add that, you know, we have it on, the book is on Amazon. I also have a Kindle version on Amazon Kindle. And the first seven chapters can be downloaded for free there. We also have it on the print versions on Books A Million and Barnes & Noble. And we have a website, davidcamm.com, and that'll give you some additional video of the second prosecutors, a clip of my interview of Charles Bonnet, where the words in his mouth are a confession, if only people would have listened. But quite a bit of information out there for anybody wishing to see it, wishing to be educated. Some people won't. Hopefully other people will, because this is a case that never, ever should have happened and never, ever should be replicated whatsoever anywhere.
Absolutely. I want to applaud your investigation and your persistence in this and applaud you with your book, Their Bloody Lies and Persecution of David Camm. I want to thank you very much. And this is part one. And thank you so much, Gary M. Dunn, for Their Bloody Lies and Persecution of David Camm.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you and good night.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to recognize the undeniable cultural influence of Black musicians, composers, singers, and songwriters. From folk music to rock and roll, jazz, and more, Black culture has shaped almost every genre of music that exists today. Join State Farm in celebrating this month and beyond. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.